Mr. Myers.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Chris Myers. I represent the appellant in this case, Shane Holloway. Shane Holloway appeals the district court's grant of summary judgment to both defendants and has two arguments. The first is that substantive due process was violated when Mr. Holloway was made to be detained in the Delaware County Jail for 9 days without ever being charged with a crime and while suffering chronic pain as a result of his blood clotting disorder, Klippel-Trenaunay syndrome, and not being allowed to take his Oxycontin, which was prescribed to him and which would have controlled his pain. With respect to the first argument, that is an argument that the sheriff of Delaware County, in his official capacity, is liable under Section 1983, the appellant maintains that substantive due process standards were violated as a result of the sheriff's policy of omission. There's no evidence in the record to suggest that the sheriff had any kind of backup plan or safeguards in place to prevent the prolonged detention of an inmate who, even though he received a probable cause determination, even though he may have had a video conference, which, by the way, did not result in reading of any criminal charges because none were ever brought, it is still a violation and offends the standards of due process when a sheriff has no plan whatsoever to watch out for inmates who suffer a prolonged detention, even though probable cause was determined. And that's not the first time that this court has addressed such an issue. In Coleman versus France, there was an inmate who was arrested with a warrant, but he was never taken before a judge or magistrate for at least 18 days. That offended due process. The sheriff in that case skated on qualified immunity grounds because it was an individual capacity claim, not an official capacity claim. And as we all know, there is no qualified immunity for a sheriff in this case because it is an official capacity case. With respect to the medical defendants, Dr. Alshami, Nurse St. Meyer, and Nurse Hamilton, there was apparently in effect in the Delaware County Jail a standard no-narcotic policy. Now, this was told to him when he first entered the jail, told everybody that he needed this pain medication, showed his prescriptions. They told him, without being medically assessed, you're not going to get your medications because we don't serve narcotics in this facility. Dr. Alshami told the plaintiff, I don't believe in prescribing Oxycontin in the jail setting. Dr. Alshami was the one who apparently formulated the policy. Nurses St. Meyer and Hamilton were the ones who followed it unthinkingly and rather blindly. And so all of them are liable in their individual capacities under Section 1983 for withholding Oxycontin, which would have treated my client's pain medication or my client's pain condition.
Well, a ruling like that from this court would invalidate that sort of prison or jail policy, which would be a pretty extraordinary result and would create pretty extraordinary law that it's illegal and unconstitutional for a jail clinical unit or a prison clinical unit to have a policy against narcotic pain medication and to try to treat pain with other non-narcotics before resorting to narcotic pain medication in an extraordinary situation. I mean, that's what your argument asks for, essentially, is to invalidate any such policy.
I think, Your Honor, I don't have to go that far, and I'm not trying to go that far here. What I'm suggesting, because this part of the case is not an official policy case.
I understand that, but okay. The facts are that the doctor said, I'm not going to use narcotics except in extraordinary situations like post-surgical pain, et cetera, or traumatic pain. Chronic pain I'm going to try to treat with non-narcotics. That was his default approach to pain management, as I understand the facts of the case. And you take issue with it. The nurses just followed that, essentially, and that's the claim. And so a reversal on your argument would basically be tantamount to a holding that sort of pain management policy by a prison or jail doctor is unconstitutional, and that's asking a lot.
Well, Your Honor, I think that this court has approached this issue before. In Walker versus Benjamin, cited on page 7 of my reply brief, inmate medical conditions sometimes warrant narcotic pain medications, and they do. What I'm asking for is an individualized assessment by the medical provider in each case, not just a blanket rule to be applied. The cookie-cutter approach doesn't work. And so I didn't mean to overstate our position with respect to this part of our argument. But on the facts of this case, and you talk about a unique circumstance, it's not very often that someone comes to jail with a full-blown port wine stain over their face, has Klippel-Trenaunay syndrome, is in chronic pain because of it, and has his Oxycontin and his prescriptions to show that he needs it. That's the facts of this case. And what I'm asking for is for this court to reverse the district court to determine that there were questions of fact that could have been presented to a jury on this issue.
The undisputed facts are also that the plaintiff refused to take the alternative pain medication.
Your Honor, he couldn't. I think it's also set forth in his affidavit that he could not take the lesser effective medication because it made his stomach upset. I mean, he was in his cell, doubled over, on the floor, vomiting. He couldn't take that stuff because of his blood clotting disorder.
If I could go back to the detention part of the case.
Yes, Judge.
It's my understanding that the plaintiff had his probable cause hearing within 24 hours of arrest and booking into the jail.
That's right.
In accordance with state and federal law. And that his hearing was continued for 72 hours pursuant to express state law that permits that interim detention before a charge is issued. And then when a charge was not issued on that 72nd hour, he was released. It's pretty hard to say that following express provisions of state law shocks the conscience for purposes of a substantive due process claim.
Yes, ma'am. Judge, I didn't say this argument was an easy one. What I'm suggesting, though, is that when you add up all the time that Mr. Holloway suffered, he got his 48 hours pursuant to Gersten and Riverside, and then he got his extra time pursuant to this Indiana statute, okay, which, of course, doesn't include weekends. But by the time you add it all up, 9 days went by, and he was never charged with a crime.
Right, but that basically amounts, again, to a categorical ruling, if we were to agree with you, that the Indiana statutory provisions for this additional 72 hours of detention to permit a charge to be filed is categorically unconstitutional.
Well, Your Honor,
or at least
maybe
if
not,
it includes weekends that are excluded.
Well, maybe not categorically, at least as to the facts of this case, and again, any due process analysis, whether it's under Armstrong versus Squadrito, or even Coleman versus France, you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. And in this case, the circumstances of my client being incarcerated for 9 days without ever having criminal charges brought against him, made to suffer from chronic pain because he didn't get his medication, violates substantive due process. And with respect to the question of whether a categorical rule should be made, perhaps maybe it does. What we are looking for here is some kind of a ruling with respect to the constitutional outer boundaries beyond which a sheriff cannot further incarcerate an inmate, even though probable cause was found. Now, they struggled with this, that is, the Supreme Court did, in Gersten and then Riverside. In Gersten, the Supreme Court said you need to be promptly taken before judge or magistrate.
Those are Fourth Amendment decisions.
I understand that, Judge, but I think there is Fourth Amendment due process law and 14th Amendment substantive due process. And sometimes the cases borrow from each other to explain these rulings. And what I'm suggesting here is that there has to be some kind of limit beyond which an inmate cannot be incarcerated, even though probable cause has already been found.
Are you suggesting, Mr. Myers, that the sheriff should have some internal clock, so to speak, where after a period of time, I don't know what you would suggest, he should make some sort of application to the court to review the direction he was currently under?
Absolutely. Either a clock or some kind of safeguard policy. In some of the smaller counties that I'm familiar with, because they don't have that many inmates, but they have what's called a board. And again, getting back to Gersten, they call it the 48-hour board. And they actually have a little clock for each inmate, and they know where they're going with respect to that particular inmate. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Myers. Mr. Stewart?
May it please the court, my name is Ian Stewart. I represent the Delaware County Sheriff, and we're here on the claim of whether it shocks the conscience under the 14th Amendment for the Delaware County Sheriff to detain an individual for 8 days when the sheriff has been ordered by two different judges to detain an inmate for 2 days. And the answer to that is no, it does not shock the conscience for the sheriff to simply follow the directive, follow the exact orders from the court. In this case, we have a plaintiff who was detained on Tuesday, September 29th at 5 p.m. He was released then on Wednesday, October 7th at 10:30 a.m. So we have an 8-day detention. Within 24 hours of his arrest, he had a probable cause determination made by one judge. Therefore, we don't have a Gerstein case. We're not under the Fourth Amendment. We're under the 14th Amendment because there was a probable cause determination done within not just 48 hours, but 24 hours. So then we have the question of when his initial hearing occurred. That occurred on Friday, October 2nd, around 11 a.m., so within 72 hours, or under 3 days. The United States Supreme Court addressed a similar issue in the Baker versus McCollin case, where an individual was detained for 3 days without any type of hearing, and the court said 3 days, that doesn't give you a claim. It does not give you any claim under the 14th Amendment. The plaintiff is stretching then to the Coleman case. And in Coleman, the individual was detained for 18 days with no initial hearing. And the Coleman case hinged on whether the procedural safeguards that would be present for initial hearing would give rise to a claim. Respectfully, those procedural safeguards were met within 72 hours when Mr. Holloway had his initial hearing. This is not a case where there was a case of mistaken identity where they brought in an individual and the individual was left to simply sit in a jail. Instead, at the initial hearing, all the procedural safeguards identified in Coleman were met. The court confirmed Mr. Holloway's identity. The court then read the charges and the probable cause affidavit. There were no charges because the prosecutor had not filed any charges. However, Mr. Holloway was not left to wonder why he'd been arrested. The court specifically said, a prior judge has found there was probable cause for your arrest for dealing in a controlled substance as a B felony and also maintaining a common nuisance.
So the first probable cause determination within 24 hours of arrest
was not a hearing.
It was on paper.
It was on paper. And under Gerstein, that's acceptable.
Right.
It does not need to be a hearing. But yes, the first probable cause determination was not a hearing. It was simply on affidavit. The hearing then occurred within 72 hours.
Okay.
And it was at that hearing then that the court also then went through his rights, said you have a right to remain silent, you have a right to speedy trial. The court appointed him an attorney. In fact, Mr. Holloway met with his attorney twice on the Saturday and then on the Monday of his detention. And then as far as bail, the court addressed bail, but the court said, based on these charges, I'm going to hold you without bail. And then the court said, prosecutor, do you need more time to file? The prosecutor said yes, and the court specifically said, fine, I'm going to give you 72 hours, excluding the weekends, so I'm going to give you 5 days to file charges, and if you don't file charges by 9 a.m., Mr. Holloway will be free to go. And that's what happened. No charges were filed at 9 a.m., and by 10:30, he was out of the jail. So when you have plaintiffs saying that Mr. Holloway was left there indefinitely, that's not true. You have the sheriff following what the law is. Within 48 hours, there was a probable cause determination. Within 3 days, there was the initial hearing. When the court ordered that at 9 a.m. on Wednesday, if there's no charges, you're going to be released, that's what happened. So there is no constitutional violation. and there's certainly nothing that would shock the conscience. There's no evidence of any intent on the part of the sheriff to injure Mr. Holloway. The only evidence is that the sheriff was doing what he was ordered to do by a court. So there is no 14th Amendment violation, and there's certainly no Monell claim. The policy, if there is any policy, is following what a court wants to do. And I think, as the court has found, that is not something you can be held liable for. I'd be happy to answer any questions the court may have.
Apparently not. All right, thank you, Mr. Stewart. Ms. Dillon.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Carol Dillon. I represent the three medical defendants, Dr. Alshami, Nurse St. Meyer, and Nurse Hamilton, and both of those nurses are licensed practical nurses. When Mr. Holloway entered the Delaware County Jail, Dr. Alshami became his primary care physician. Now, he didn't have a choice in that matter, but his primary care switched from his private physician to Dr. Alshami. As any private physician, whether in the jail setting or the private setting, takes on a primary care of a new patient, they have to make a determination of what medications they think are appropriate. And they use their own, you know, whether you call it a policy, a belief, a medical opinion, or judgment, it's what Dr. Alshami thinks. And Dr. Alshami doesn't think that OxyContin is medically necessary to treat chronic pain. And what the plaintiff said earlier isn't true. It's not a cookie-cutter policy. He said, I do prescribe narcotics. In fact, in the jail setting, if someone has had a recent trauma, like coming off of a car accident and then getting arrested, or someone who has had a surgery, under those circumstances, he does think narcotic pain medication is appropriate. But for someone with chronic ongoing pain, he simply doesn't. And what I want to do is just pretend that this happened in the private sector, and we wouldn't even have a lawsuit, not for negligence or deliberate indifference. If Mr. Holloway had walked into Dr. Alshami's office, which he has a private office in Fairdale, Kentucky, and said, I'm looking for a new primary care doctor, Dr. Alshami would have said the exact same thing. Well, I don't treat chronic pain with narcotic pain medication, but I will prescribe you substitutes. I will also prescribe you three medications, Donatol, Vistarol, and Clonidine, to make sure you have no symptoms or withdrawal side effects from coming off the OxyContin. Now, the only in that situation, Dr. Alshami wouldn't contact the prior primary care provider. He would make his own judgment, like every primary care provider does. The only thing he may do is gather a medical record from the prior physician to confirm the diagnoses and confirm the medications. Well, the jail did that in this case as well. The only difference, if this were in the private setting, would be that Mr. Holloway would have had a choice, and he could have said, no, thank you, I'll find another primary care provider who does prescribe narcotics. Nobody would have accused Dr. Alshami of negligence in that scenario, and no one certainly would have accused him of deliberate indifference. And so to say that there should be a difference for jail physicians as opposed to private physicians, I think, is where Your Honor was leading to, saying it was getting a little worrisome for the court to do that. And I think the greater concern is not to say that jails can't have no narcotics policies. I think the greater concern is for the court to say that a primary care provider in a jail can't have certain medical opinions, such as narcotics are not medically necessary for chronic pain. And if that's the case, then we're really taking away his ability to have his own medical opinions, and we're really taking away his ability to practice medicine properly. With regard to the nurses, I think what Your Honor said earlier is entirely correct. They're licensed practical nurses. They don't prescribe medication. And so for the plaintiff to make the allegation that they denied OxyContin, they can't deny something that wasn't prescribed by a physician, because nurses don't prescribe, nor do they discontinue. They follow doctor's orders. In this case, the primary care physician for the jail, Dr. Alshami, didn't prescribe OxyContin. The nurses, therefore, couldn't give that to him. Under the Section 1983 case law, we can't hold them to be deliberately indifferent for failing to do something that they didn't have the ability to do in the first place. The job of the nurses at the jail is to assess the inmate, provide that information to the physician so he can make a reasoned, intelligent judgment about what medications are appropriate. And the timing of this case is unfortunate, because Dr. Alshami was actually at the jail that day, and Mr. Holloway came in several hours later. Dr. Alshami did assess the patient 7 days later when he was at the jail the next time. That's no different either than the private setting. When you call your primary care doctor to say, I've got something, I need an appointment, you don't get in right away or the next day. 7 days is pretty reasonable. And the nursing staff can take your information, pass it along to the doctor, and the doctor can decide whether you need to get in early or not. So both Dr. Alshami and the nurses in this case didn't do anything that any nurse or any primary care provider does on the outside. So just because it happens in a jail setting doesn't make it a constitutional violation. If there's no questions, I will just ask that this court affirm the district court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dillon. Mr. Myers.
I'm going to limit my remarks on rebuttal, I believe, to the medical defendants. Mr. Holloway indeed did not have a choice with respect to what physician he received when he stepped foot into the Delaware County Jail. He had no other choice but to be under the supervision and care, apparently, of Dr. Alshami, who admittedly didn't see him for at least 7 days. And that speaks volumes, I think, to the due process violation with respect to not addressing his chronic pain in and of itself. But more to the point regarding his need for narcotic pain medication, there are some situations where a jail inmate needs extreme pain medication to deal with his chronic pain. This was one of those situations. Dr. Alshami didn't even address it for at least 7 days because he didn't see them. He didn't see Mr. Holloway. The nurses who did see Mr. Holloway basically just reiterated their mantra and the policy, no narcotics in jail. That's Dr. Alshami's statement. It wasn't based upon a medical diagnosis or evaluation or anything else, just his belief. That's not enough. And in this case, Mr. Holloway suffered extreme chronic pain to a very unique situation that he had, that he demonstrated. Dr. Alshami wasn't even there for 7 days to see it.
Was he... How soon was the doctor advised, though, of his custody and his symptoms?
Your Honor, I don't know exactly when the nurses told Dr. Alshami.
It might have been a shorter time frame when he directed what medication he did receive. Is that correct?
It could have been. I don't have the specific time frame in front of me, but I do know that he never did receive his pain medication that he needed. I don't think there's any evidence that Dr. Alshami consulted.
But he was put on the alternative medication regimen upon booking into the jail or soon thereafter. And he didn't go 7 days before he was put on the alternative
regimen. I'm not suggesting that. But what I am suggesting, and I'm going to get the quote wrong, but less efficacious remedies simply will not do if the need for more severe medication is demonstrated, and that's what happened here.
Aren't you bumping into the law in this circuit that a prisoner is not entitled to the best care possible? And
no, Your Honor, I don't think I am.
Juxtapose that with the discretion that the doctor has to determine, as argued, the best care that he thinks is possible?
Yes, sir. I understand the concept, but I don't think I'm butting up against that. In this case, Mr. Holloway's contending he didn't even get the minimal care. He's contending that the care that he received was woefully insufficient and amounted to deliberate indifference. His pain wasn't dealt with at all.
As I recall the record, too, he had the cell right next to the nurse's station, didn't he?
Your Honor, for all the good that it did him, that may be true.
Didn't he make some statement in the record, as I saw it, that the nurses saved his life? Didn't he make some?
Well, Your Honor, there's no dispute that the nurses cared for him, but they cared for him with respect to his withdrawal symptoms, which were, of course, caused by being taken off the narcotic OxyContin. You know, oddly enough, when he got released, he went right to his primary care physician, spent 4 or 5 days in the Goshen Hospital, and was promptly put back on his OxyContin. This is something that this man needed and didn't get. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the fifth case. United States.